So Parshas Naso has two back-to-back parshias, two back-to-back sets of halachas. One is the parsha of Sota, the woman who is suspected of unfaithfulness. She goes through the Sota ritual with the water and so on. And the next parsha is the parsha of Nazir. Torah says, Isho Isha ki yafli lindor neder Nazir lahazir l'Hashem. He takes a vow of Nazirus, and we know the basic contours of Nazirus: no wine, grape products, no tumah, no cutting hair, and so on. That's the parsha of Nazir. There is a famous connection Rashi brings between Sota and Nazir. It says that Sota hair is being used as a symbol of immoral conduct, improper conduct, and it's caused by lust, by passion, by urges. These things are enhanced by wine, by getting drunk. So someone who realizes what happens when he loses control and gets drunk, and he sees what happens to the Sota, the problems caused, so he takes a vow of Nazirus to avoid Yayin as a precaution against falling into these types of temptations. Now, there's a very interesting discussion in the Talmud in several places, which is the question of whether we consider Nazir a good thing or a bad thing, or a combination of both good and bad. In general, the broader question, what does Judaism think about asceticism, about choosing to withdraw from this world, to avoid pleasures, to avoid things which might be inherently legitimate, just to minimize one's enjoyment, one's indulgence in the world? The Talmud has a number of conflicting passages on this point. This is discussed in Bava Kamma, in Nedarim, in Tanis, and there's actually a fair amount of contradiction and of dispute, and not even so clear how we paskin. But particularly interesting is the fact that some of the Talmud's comments in this context about whether Nazirus is a good thing or a bad thing actually bears upon a broader question, or narrower question, but an important practical question, lahalacha, the question of self-harm, about the halachic prohibition against self-harm, as we'll see, is actually derived from certain interpretations of Nazirus. This question of self-harm comes up in questions about optional surgery, cosmetic surgery, plastic surgery when it isn't absolutely essential, and so on. So as we'll see when we explore this topic, we'll discuss how the Torah, how Chazal looked at Nazirus, how they looked at fasting and other types of abstemiousness, and how that bears on questions of actual physical harm, choosing to physically harm yourself, and how that's applied in cases like surgery, where typically one is doing it for a good reason. And the question is going to be, of course, whether the good reason, whether it's a health reason or just a body image reason, whether those reasons can outweigh the fact that you are objectively, undeniably inflicting some kind of short-term, at least, pain or harm upon yourself. So the Talmud, as I said, actually has these conflicting passages about Nazirus, whether Nazirus is good or bad. One of the discussions in Bava Kamma, the beginning of section 1, it brings an opinion that says that you are not allowed to harm yourself. It brings machlokas. The halacha follows the opinion that you are not allowed to harm yourself for no reason, at least. What's the source for this? The Gemara tries various sources. One of them is a celebrated statement of Rabbi Elazar HaKapar, a Tana, about Nazirus. He notes that when the Torah discusses Nazirus, so it says, in one of the stages of the various karbanos, it says, he brings an asham. He brings a karban. It says, and the Torah says, V'chiper alav me'asher chatal ha'nefesh, chatas, actually, he brings an asham too, but there's a chatas involved. Chatas is the word means chet. The Torah says, asher chatal ha'nefesh, the Nazir has sinned, so he brings a karban chatas. Unlike most karban chatas in the Torah, where many of them, we know what the person sinned, what he did wrong, here the Torah is not entirely clear, not clear at all, about what the Nazir actually did wrong. As the Ramban notes in section 3 here, the Ramban says, Tam ha-chatas yakrif ha-nazir b'yom lo simei nizro. The reason for this chatas, lo nisparish. The Torah simply doesn't tell us. Whatever we have to say is speculation or tradition. So the Talmud tells us this opinion of Rabbi Elazar HaKapar. It says, what is the chatal ha-nefesh? Be'ezer nefesh chata. What has he done wrong? Ela shetzia ratzim ha-nayayin. Nazir is prohibited to do three things. Two of them are not things which are, you know, particularly painful, avoiding mesim and cutting hair. I guess we'd rather have neat haircuts, but it's not something which is, you don't feel deprived and you don't feel like you have to abstain in the same way that you do from wine. Wine was a staple, even more so then than it is today. The person's abstained from wine. Tier atmo, he pained himself, he hurt himself, and therefore advarim kal v'chomer. We can infer a general principle, kal v'chomer, mazesh l'tier atmo element ayayin nekrochote, someone who merely abstained from one particular pleasure, the pleasure of wine, is called a sinner. Hamitzar atmo b'chal davar, someone who deprives himself more broadly, more generally. Rashi says, based on Gemara's elsewhere, Rashi says it means someone who deprives himself of all food, not all pleasures, but all food, who says he's going to be betanis, who's going to fast, alachas kama v'kama, is called a sinner. Similar passage in Gemara Nedarim. The next line, mikan kalayoshe betanis, it brings this statement of Reb Elazar Kapper, and it says, we infer from this, anyone who's yoshe betanis, who fasts, is called a chote, he's a sinner. Now, the Gemara points out an interesting fact. The Nazir brings karbanos in two phases. An ordinary Nazir, where everything goes right for, who does everything he's supposed to do, finishes his term, 30 days or longer, whatever term he accepted, brings karbanos. But then there is an interrupted Nazir, a special Nazir who violated his Nazirus, who became Tame for a mace. He brings a special set of karbanos. He has to restart the Nazirus, but before he starts, in expiation of the Tumah, he has to bring a set of karbanos. One of those is the Chatas, and that's where the Torah says, Asher Chatal HaNefesh, he has sinned. So the simple reading of the text implies that it has something to do with the Tumah. Yet, on the one hand, the Torah implies it wasn't really his fault. The mace died with Pesah Pissom, suddenly, without any fault on his part. Anyway, the Talmud understands, at least according to Reb Elazar Kapper, that this really refers to a regular Nazir. The carbon he's bringing here really refers to a sin that every Nazir commits. So why is the carbon only brought by someone who became Tamei, this Chatas, this particular Chatas? So it says, Shana Bechetu, a regular Nazir is only one term Nazirus. This guy became a two-term Nazirus. He's doubling down on his Nazirus. Again, might not have been his fault, but he's now guilty of having a prolonged Nazirus. So that's why he needs the carbon. But again, that's a technical issue the Gemara has. But the point is, the bottom line is, that Rabbi Elazar Kapper understands that the sin of Nazirus is the deprivation, the deliberate choice to deprive himself of a relatively more or less innocent pleasure like wine. That is why he brings a carbon chatas.
And the concept of the biggest volume in other situations of chatas is not applied to
that. Right. The Torah doesn't say v'hizvada. I don't know. Often I don't know if there's any form of veto here. Do we tell him to say at the carbon, I'm sorry for becoming a nazir? I'm not sure. Yeah, chatas is tshuva. Yeah, you want to know if there's a verbal vidu they articulate explicitly? I don't know, but yeah. So that's the chet according to these Gemaras. Then the Gemara in Tanis actually brings what seem to be three opinions. The Gemara is discussing Tanis and equates Tanis to Nazir, someone who abstains from food, someone who abstains from wine. So the Gemara here brings three opinions about how does Chazal look at someone who voluntarily deprives himself of food. So first we have the opinion of Shmuel, Amar Shmuel, Kalayoshe Betanis Nikrachote. Someone who chooses to deprive himself of food is called a sinner. And that's the Shita of Reb Elazar Kapper. The Gemara says the same Shita we've been discussing until now. A Nazir is called a Chote. Someone who accepts a voluntary Tanis, without a good reason at least, is called a Chote. That is the opinion of Shmuel. Then the Gemara brings an opinion, Rabbi Elazar Amar Nikrachadosh. On the contrary, he's called a holy person. Many religions have this, holy men, those who abstain from ordinary pleasures. So he's holy, according to his opinion. The Gemara adds a proviso, it depends, it has a contradiction, it has a technical question, it comes out saying it's only if it's matzil turi nafshe, only if you're strong enough and robust enough to be able to do it without suffering, I guess, permanently or seriously. But you are called a kaddush. If you choose to fast, you are called a kaddush. The third shita is Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says, Nikra chasid. Someone who's that Nikra Chassid, it's actually, the Gemara is ambiguous, who is called a Chassid? Rashi says, the Masana, if you choose to fast, you're called a Chassid. That's very similar to the previous view, you're called a Kaddish, you're called a Chassid. Tosafot says just the opposite. Someone who avoids fasting is called a Chassid. This is really similar to the first view, that fasting is wrong, and you're a Chassid if you make sure to avoid fasting. You can read the Gemara to see the intricate details of how the Pesukim are being read, but basically Reish Lakish says something which is somewhat ambiguous. You're called a chassid either dafka for fasting or dafka for not fasting, but in any event, Shmuel and Rabbi Elazar are on opposite sides of the fence. Shmuel says that someone who sits in a, someone who accepts a tannis for no good reason is called a chote. Rabbi Elazar says, on the contrary, he is called a kadosh, and Reish Lakish says one or the other, more or less, although it's not clear exactly which one. Now, up till now, we've been treating it as one or the other, either good or bad, either chote or kadosh and chassid. Tosfos makes things a little more complicated. Tosfos introduces the possibility that it's both at the same time. You can be both a sinner and a righteous person at the same time. How can that be? So Tosfos says, Tosfos has a kasha, that Shmuel in this Gemara says that Yoshev B'tanis is Nikra Chote, yet elsewhere Shmuel seems to think that it's a mitzvah, that it's a good idea to accept Tanis on yourself. He brings a Gemara in Bava Kamma, not going to get into the details of the Gemara, but Tosfos has essentially a contradiction. So Tosfos says that it's both. It's inherently sinful, but there's also a mitzvah, you need it sometimes, the abstention itself is sinful, you're depriving yourself of God's pleasures, but there also is an element of mitzvah, sometimes you need it, as the Gemara says, and if a person needs this kind of strong medicine to avoid temptation, to avoid falling into sin, then it's a mitzvah to abstain from wine, but there still is some element of chet. Sounds very paradoxical, how can you have both chet and mitzvah at the same time? Tosfos manages to find one sort of paradigm for this. The halacha is, if someone has a bad dream on Shabbos, he does a tanis chalom even on Shabbos. We don't do this very commonly today, but the halacha is, in the early poskim, that a person has a bad dream, he can undertake a tanis chalom even on Shabbos. However, then he has to accept another tanis afterward to expiate the sin of having fasted on Shabbos. So on the one hand, we call it a sin, you need a kapara. On the other hand, it's the right thing to do, and you get schar for it. Doesn't really explain what sense that makes, and how, you know, we discussed a while back, we discussed Avera Lishma, the idea that sometimes there's something which is called an Avera, but you have a greater motivation to do it, so it becomes a mitzvah. Still, you'd think that means it stops becoming an Avera, although we said sometimes it can somehow retain the character of an Avera and still become a mitzvah at the same time. Tosfos seems to be willing to concede that that's what's going on in these cases. The act itself is intrinsically sinful, but in context, you have a really good reason for doing it, so it becomes a mitzvah. Not really clear, again, theologically, how to understand that, what that means. But basically, we do have several opinions. We do have opinions that say Reb Elazar HaKapar and Shmuel and maybe Reish Lakish all say that it's problematic to arbitrarily accept Nazirus or Tanis. And on the other hand, we have Reb Elazar and maybe Reish Lakish who say it's actually a mitzvah, and Tosfos' opinion that it can actually be both. The Ramban doesn't directly relate to these statements of Chazal, but the Ramban emphatically says Nazirus is a mitzvah. To the extent he says that, you know why a person brings a carbon when he brings a chatas when his Nazirus is concluded? He says because he's still at the conclusion, I think, of the normal Nazirus, not the Tumah Nazirus, but he says, you know why he brings a carbon? He says because ending Nazirus itself is sinful. You're on a high mandrega, you're on a lofty spiritual level. You're abstaining from things like wine, which are decadent and lead to problems. You really should have the spiritual commitment to keep on going. If you're going to voluntarily give up your loftier stature and go back to being an ordinary person, that itself is sinful. So the sin is the opposite. Not that the sin is becoming a Nazir. The sin is kind of backsliding from your Nazirus and giving up your spiritual plateau and descending to the level of ordinary people. That itself is the sin. That, again, very much the opposite of those who say that the Nazirus itself is sinful. The Ramban says, on the contrary, once you've shown that you're able to do that and you're not interested, you're going back to being an ordinary person, that is the sin. So as I mentioned earlier, the Gemara in Bava Kamma actually brings this idea that becoming a Nazir is sinful. It actually brings us as a source for the prohibition against self-harm. The Gemara says, Asur l'adam lachvel ba'atzmo, it is prohibited to harm yourself. What is the source? The Gemara tries various sources. The conclusion, the final suggestion of the Gemara, is that the source is from the prohibition to become a Nazir. For, not prohibition exactly, but from the categorization of the Nazir as being a sinner. The sin is because he willingly deprived himself of pleasure. So certainly to actually deprive yourself of by fasting, or certainly to actively inflict harm on yourself, is certainly an illegitimate act in Judaism. We actually pass in like this. We do pass in that choosing to harm yourself is an avera. It's not clear that we pass in that abstaining from food or wine is a sin. As we saw, there are several shittas in the Gemara The Rambam, Rav Moshe Feinstein, argues repeatedly about we paskin that it's not a sin to arbitrarily accept fasting. However, the idea of self-harm, whether the source is, as the Gemara says, from the Zeros or some other source, this we do actually paskin, is actually a prohibition, and you are not allowed to engage in gratuitous self-harm. The question, of course, is what is gratuitous? Everyone is going to agree, Rav Moshe Feinstein says repeatedly, everyone's going to agree that undergoing surgery for a health reason, for to improve your health, to cure a disease, is certainly permitted. The gain, the health benefit, the hoped-for health benefit, the anticipated health benefit, is better than the short-term pain, or you wouldn't be doing the surgery. And that certainly is mutter. That is pretty much an uncontroversial position. The question is, what about different types of harm that are not for such an unequivocally good reason, so to speak? One of the classic questions discussed at length by the many poskim throughout the 20th century is cosmetic surgery in various forms. Plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery in its various forms, is that permitted? On the one hand, you're going under the knife, you're being cut, it's going to hurt, and maybe not while you're under anesthesia, but it's going to hurt afterwards, probably, or sometimes. On the other hand, if you're doing it, you probably think that the long-term gain in you'll be happier with your body or whatever it is, your romantic prospects will be enhanced, your job prospects will be enhanced, whatever it is, it's worth it to you. So using the language of economics, that means that the value is greater than the cost. So the question is that mutter or not? Does that fall under the prohibition of self-harm or not? This is a question that is discussed by a number of 20th century poskim. Not only is the issue, when they discuss elective surgery like this, not only do they discuss the question of self-harm, they actually discuss three or four or five other issues that are potentially problematic with regard to elective cosmetic surgery. They discuss machnas atzmul sakana, the unnecessary assumption of risk to life or limb. They discuss questions about, for men, if it's considered a feminine form of feminine procedure, like certain kinds of grooming, other prohibitions, as we'll discuss. Now, lemaisa, with this particular prohibition of self-harm, the short summary is that the general consensus of the poskim is that it is mutter. Some of the other issues, poskim are a little more reluctant to be mutter, but in general, the strong consensus of poskim is that surgery, even cosmetic, even purely elective surgery, is mutter, and we'll see some of their analysis as we go. However, it's not quite that simple, as we'll see, that the poskim do go back and forth on whether indeed it is mutter or not. We should also clarify, it's not really a question of black and white, simple surgery for cancer and surgery because a person wants a straighter nose. There's a lot in between. A person could have been disfigured in a fire, in an accident, and doesn't just want to have a nose more like a model. He has terribly disfiguring things. A person could have deformities of other sorts. Not all the poskim are always clear exactly what they're talking about. Some make it clear that we're talking about, some of them, especially the lenient ones, make it clear they weren't just talking about somebody wants a slightly more model level body, but someone wants just to remove something really unsightly. So it's important to consider what type of procedure we're talking about. Additionally, especially when we discuss the other questions of risk, obviously the medical technology has advanced. A lot of poskim were concerned with anesthesia. Obviously, these things improve all the time. Although, again, they're not risk-free. You sign those consent forms when you go to the hospital. They warn you about, Dr. Edinger can tell us, all kinds of potentially fatal and other unpleasant consequences. Then when you actually ask the doctor about it, they tell you, no, the risks are really very low. We just have to get you to sign this for legal reasons. But whatever. But the point is, the concerns the poskim have, are these are the two big ones they discuss. Does it fall under the question of self-harm? And is it a question of unacceptable risk? As I mentioned briefly, the former consideration is generally considered to be okay. The latter consideration is not so simple. Let's consider what some of the leading 20th century poskim have said on this topic. Rav Moshe Feinstein has several tshuvos that bear on this question. One of them directly addresses the issue of cosmetic surgery. Other ones address the general questions of self-harm from other aspects. In the cosmetic surgery tshuva number 4 here, the question was about a nara, a young woman, who wanted to beautify herself. Doesn't sound like she had any major deformity. It sounds like she just wanted to improve her looks. And her reason was to improve her marital prospects, he says, because she yikpatsu alav lakadsha. And how does she want to do this? The doctors have invented some kind of surgical procedure that would improve her looks. She wanted to know, is it permitted? So Moshe's discussion focuses entirely on the question of self-harm. He brings the Gemara in Bava Kamma that says that self-harm is prohibited. We derive it from the idea of the Nazir. Now he brings an interesting machlokas between Tosus and the Rambam. The Rambam, in number two over here, when the Rambam codifies the prohibition against self-harm, the Rambam says it is prohibited to strike somebody, to hit somebody else, even yourself, he says. But the Rambam, when he talks about Asur Adam Lachbal Bein Ba'atzmo Bein B'Chaveiro, it is prohibited to strike either yourself or somebody else. The Rambam seems to include the prohibition against self-harm and the general prohibition against harming anyone. And the Rambam says you violate this if you strike somebody derech nitzayon, nun sadi yud vav nun. Very strange word, nitzayon. Sounds like it means aggressively or in a fight or in adversarially. The word is so strange. There's another text in the Rambam. Some have derech bizayon in a disparaging or derogatory way. Also an odd term to use to characterize an assault. But the Rambam, clearly this word is qualifying somehow what kind of assault we're talking about, what kind of injury we're talking about, derech nitzayon, derech bizayon. The Achronim will argue, the Rambam seems to indicate the prohibition is only violated if the striking is unwholesome. If it's, aggressive and unwholesome and not for a positive, constructive purpose. According to the Rambam, therefore, many Achronim, including Rav Feinstein, argue that surgery, which is certainly not aggressive, it's certainly not meant to in an adversarial and aggressive way, it would be mutar. Tosus, however, in Bava Kamma, does not seem to rule that way. Tosus is discussing the ins and outs of that sugya in Bava Kamma. Tosus flat out says that the prohibition against self-harm is even if the person does it for a sober, objective, economic purpose. He's actually referring to a Mishnah in Bava Kamma. That's where this whole sugya begins, actually. I didn't bring the whole thing just for space constraints, but the Mishnah talks about a woman who somebody spilled oil in a public place, and the oil was going to run off. They were a little less squeamish about these things than we are today. She wanted to catch the oil and save it, so free oil. So she removed the kerchief from her head, and she used it to scoop up, to gather up the oil. It must have been a thick piece of cloth or something. She used it to scoop up the oil. And the Mishnah, when it characterizes her conduct, the Mishnah says she is chovel ba'atma, afal pish ena rashai. You know, since she did it to herself, obviously there's no liability for anyone here. But the Mishnah says ena rashai. A person would not be permitted to do that. It was not chovel in the sense of physical injury. It was chovel in the sense of humiliation, public humiliation. It was disgraceful to remove one's head covering like that in the middle of the street in that time. So therefore, it was considered a form of boshes, as we've discussed. It's one of the five causes of action for personal injury. And it calls the person chovel and eino rashoi. The Gemara brings a contradiction. The Gemara goes back and forth. And the Gemara eventually segues into the discussion of chovel ba'atmo in general. The Tosfos says, in the course of his analysis of the sugya, Tosfos says, chovel ba'atmo is prohibited even if someone has a good reason, as that woman did. Her reason was to economic reason, to save some valuable oil. It is still prohibited. Tosfos seems to explicitly understand that self-harm or even self-degradation is prohibited, even if one has, there's certainly no nitzayon, no bizayon, nothing aggressive about it. It was simply a pragmatic, sober economic decision. Tosfos nevertheless seems to feel that it is prohibited. So Rav Moshe Feinstein acknowledges this. He presents it as machlokas, Rambam and Tosfos. He seems to side with the Rambam. He tries to limit the prohibition, even according to the broader opinion that says it applies even when it's not derech nitzayon. He still tries to limit it in various ways. At the end of the day, I don't fully understand how he gets around the clear implication of the Mishnah that it's even if it is no malicious intent whatsoever, it's simply to make some money, it's still prohibited. He doesn't really, as far as I can tell, doesn't squarely address that. But nevertheless, Rav Moshe rules the Iker is like the Rambam, or at least a slightly broader version of the Rambam, that the prohibition of self-harm is only if it's done in a nihilistic, aggressive, degrading, adversarial way. Something like surgery, which is done with the full consent and cooperation, and the patient may be paying very good money for this even. Certainly, this is not the prohibition of harm, or neither harm nor self-harm. There's no prohibition of self-harm for the patient. There's obviously no prohibition of harming another for the surgeon. Therefore, Moshe rules, in his case, of the young woman who wanted to improve her looks for marriage, Moshe says it is fine. Now, interestingly enough, Moshe has two other tshuvas, which are not directly discussing plastic surgery. They're discussing other facets of the sugya of self-harm, in which he takes a much more stringent view, a much broader interpretation of the self-harm prohibition. As a matter of fact, the immediately prior tshuva to this one about the plastic surgery was about dieting. A woman or a man, I think he's discussing women, I'm not sure if it's limited to women, but woman wants to diet, wants to deprive herself of food, of quantity, the quantity of food that she would like, of certain types of food that she would like to consume. She's doing this either for health reasons or for appearances. Is that mutter? So Moshe says, health reasons, no question, it's mutter. Like we said, same thing with the surgery. Anything she's doing for health is certainly permitted. If she's doing it for appearances, Ramosha says, then he is not so sure. Ramosha actually makes a distinction between cases like fasting or nazirus and actual harm, like cutting yourself with a knife. He says, simple deprivation, like nazirus, he says, it would definitely be mutter if you had an overarching reason that justifies what you're doing. If you're depriving yourself of wine because it'll save you money, because you have some objective reason, that's fine. Actual harm, like actually cutting yourself, Ramosha argues, would be prohibited even if you had a really good reason. Even if somehow you stood to gain a lot of money by inflicting actual harm, that would be prohibited. So Ramosha initially argues that actually fasting, he says, actually is physically unpleasant. It's not just like, he says, depriving yourself of wine, you like it, it tastes good, you desire it, so you're not yielding to your desires. That's just deprivation, he says. But actually fasting and not eating to the point where you physically suffer, you're physically hungry and uncomfortable and ill, he says. Again, that's a pretty extreme case of dieting, but you know, dieting to the point that you feel, Ramosha distinguishes between what he considers the more psychological feelings of not having something that you lust after versus actually feeling physically deprived, something you bodily need. You know, we can discuss, I guess, the psychology, the neural pathways of how different they actually are. But Ramosha makes this distinction, and he actually says the latter category, causing yourself physical harm, even via fasting, would not be a simple matter. He's not so sure it should be mutter. He goes back and forth. He says there is basis for leniency, but he's not really so sure it's mutter. Similarly, in earlier tshuva, he talks about donating blood. Ramosha is of the opinion that donating blood is permitted, certainly to save somebody else's, you know, save somebody else's life, or another Jew. Even to save another Jew's health, you can certainly donate blood. But if you're just doing it for money, to donate to a bank or for research, something which is with no direct benefit to anyone, others have argued that the blood bank itself is certainly going to help someone sooner or later. But putting that aside, let's just, for simplicity's sake, let's talk about donating blood in some context where it will not particularly benefit anyone. Is that mutter? Ramosha discusses the prohibition of chovel ba'atmo. He seems to think that it's a serious issue. He makes the same point that real chovel ba'atmo, unlike simply depriving yourself of wine, real chovel ba'atmo is not mutter, even if you have a good reason, even if the blood bank is paying you for your blood, even if you have some concrete objective reason that is not really such a good heter. Ramosha then has another heter, which he's not so sure about, because bloodletting used to be medicinal in Talmudic times, so even today, maybe it's mutter. I'm not sure that science today thinks it was ever medicinal. It's one of those questions about the science of the Talmud. I'm not going to get into that. Ramosha himself is not sure about this argument. Ramosha himself is not so quick to allow donating blood where it won't actually tangibly benefit another human being. So in these tshuvas, Ramosha seems to think that actually physically causing harm, even if you have a good reason, a good economic reason, it's not really sufficient reason to allow it. Chovel ba'atmo is a prohibition like other prohibitions in the Torah. The fact that you have a good reason is not necessarily sufficient reason to allow it. Yet when it comes to the plastic surgery tshuva there, He wholly endorses the Rambam's rule that it's only derech nitzayon, only if it's adversarial and aggressive. Anything that's being done in a wholesome, cooperative way is not prohibited. But l'maisa, halacha l'maisa, or Moshe's ruling is that plastic surgery, it sounds like it wasn't for any horrible deformity, it was for a simple case of just looking a little better, improving your looks, done for the sake of marriage. Or Moshe is of the opinion that that is fine, that is perfectly okay. As I said, this position is endorsed by many other leading authorities in the 20th century. One lesser known authority I brought here just because his language is interesting is in the Tshuva's Beis Avi, number 5, the Tshuva's Beis Avi of Rabbi Isaac Libus, posik in New York a half a century ago. He was asked also about a basula, again, a young woman, young single woman. She wanted to have a nose job, nituach al chotma lahaktina. Her nose was, or she felt it was, too big. It was aruch tzas, it was too long, her nose. And she thought that she would not find favor in the eyes of the young men, b'enei habachurim. And therefore, she wants to undergo a procedure to reduce her nose, rhinoplasty, I think it's called. And her parents are not sure if this is mutter. They were worried about the danger. Surgery always carries risks, we discussed before, the consent forms. So Rav Liba says there are two issues. The first issue is chovel ba'atma, the idea of self-harm. The second issue is the other prohibition about accepting on yourself unnecessary risk. So Rav Liba discusses this question of risk, and then he says, as a matter of practical halacha, it is not a problem. He says, bizmanenu, in our era, current times, he says, this is already 75 years ago probably, he says, the chokhmas harafua, medical science, has developed and evolved, advanced to a darga gvoa, to a very high level, he says. Operations, particularly superficial operations, nituchim chitzoniim, that are not open heart surgery, are not really dangerous, he says. Certainly plastic surgery, you're not messing around with the body's critical systems as much. Meisim b'chol yom, he says, they're done all the time. He says, he gives you a little medical advice. He says, the key thing in such cases, the key danger, the key thing to avoid is hazihirut mi zihumim, avoiding infections, he says. That's the big problem, not to get infected. And he says, you can have that when you pull a tooth. The dentistry, he says, dental procedures have that kind of risk. He says, nobody avoids these procedures. Nobody has to shy away. We take for granted. This is normal, everyday, tried and true stuff. We don't worry about it. So he said, a person hurts, he goes to the dentist, he does this procedure. He has bitachon, Hashem will help him. He says, here too, this young woman wants to improve her chances at marriage. So absolutely, he says, and besides the fact that it'll harm her marital prospects, he says, it also causes mental, psychological problems, he says. It causes her yisurin v'dakos, ruach v'nefesh, depression or broken spirits of various sorts. So he says, you can be matir to improve her face, he says, and so on. And he says that that's fine. He is matir. This is basically the position also adopted by Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Also says that fundamentally there's no problem of self-harm if it's being done for a constructive, serious reason. Rav Yitzchak Weiss, Dayan Weiss, Menachas Yitzchak also says that the no issue of self-harm if it's being done for a constructive reason. He actually is concerned about the danger. He actually, again, you have to consider where each of these posts were writing, how many years had passed. These were all 20th century figures. Some were earlier, some were later, different countries. Dayan Weiss lived in Israel, and in England and in Israel. He was writing in reasonably advanced, developed countries. He seems to have thought these operations were more dangerous. I don't know the exact year of his tshuva, whether they were more dangerous. A number of posts can point out that the key danger in their view is the anesthesia, if not actually the incision itself, it's the anesthesia. Yeah, I've had a minor procedure or two in my time. I've always been interested in getting the doctors to give me numbers and explain to me, so what's my risk of serious side effects, death and close to it. I'm like, no, it's pretty safe. And they would tell me something like 1 in 10,000. Like, those are not good odds. 1 in 10,000 does not make me happy. 1 in 10,000 is way too high for me to be comfortable about doing this. Again, if it's an important enough reason, you do it. But 1 in 10,000, we'd like to have better odds than that. Poskim, as we've discussed elsewhere in the context of risk management in halacha, poskim rarely engage in quantitative assessment of risk, which makes it very frustrating to try to compare one thing to another or to try to establish clear rules. We discussed, I think, in the past, we discussed smoking and things like that. The poskim often discuss questions, analyze risk in a qualitative way. They just discuss it's common, shamar psalm Hashem, and so on, but they rarely give you kind of mathematical, statistical, I guess, neither do the doctors, at least not to patients, but Dayan Weiss was more concerned about the question of risk. He was reluctant to be makil. Again, the question of self-harm, he was not that concerned about. He felt as long as it was for a constructive reason, that was fine. But the risk he was more concerned about, and so on. The one posek I'm aware of who, in principle, is opposed to these types of cosmetic procedures, who argues that it's fundamentally wrong, independent of risk, is a Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. Now, Rav Waldenberg is a very interesting case. On the one hand, he was, of all the poskim of the 20th century, major poskim, he is probably the one who is most, His name is most associated with medical ethics, with halachic medical ethics. He was in close consultation throughout his life with some of the leading medical ethicists among doctors, from doctors, Rabbi Dr. Avraham Sofer Abraham and Professor Avraham Steinberg. They have many tshuvas to him, and he half his tshuvas are about medical issues. So he was well-versed in medical technology. He was interested in the topic, and in some ways, he was actually very, very lenient. And certain, his positions on abortion are famously very lenient. On the other hand, there are certain areas in which he has very, very reactionary, very, very conservative traditional views, and this is one of them. He was vehemently opposed to cosmetic surgery. He was not asked about any specific case. This appears as a kind of corollary or coda to a general academic discussion he's having about different types of surgical procedures. So he wasn't writing halacha l'maaseh about a specific case. Nevertheless, his language is emphatic. Now again, he was not talking about someone who was disfigured or someone who has certainly like in a car accident, something like that. He was talking about, pretty clear from his language, he was talking about someone who is simply not happy with the way God made him. He thinks God could have done a better job. He'd be happier if his nose were longer or shorter or something like that. And he or she wants to engage in some kind of procedure, body modification, to simply alter the way he looks. So Rav Waldenberg basically says, Oster. He notes that the Gemara in Bava Kamma famously says, V'rapo yirape mikan shenitin reshus l'rofe l'rapos. The pasuk in Mishpatim is discussing someone who injures somebody else. It says V'rapo yirape, which primarily has a civil connotation. It means that the person who committed the tort shall be liable to pay the medical costs of his victim. But the Gemara infers, Mikan, from here we see, Shenitin Rishus L'Rofi L'Rapos. Permission is granted to the healer to practice his craft of healing. Now, many people ask, why do you need permission? What's there to require permission for? I mean, why not? Why shouldn't we? It's a mitzvah. We can help someone, help another Jew. Why should you need permission? So, Rav Waldenberg and others bring a school of thought. Some of the medieval thinkers, later thinkers, say that Judaism does have the notion that we should recognize that things are from God. Hashem made it happen the way it did, and therefore, who are you to try to contravene God's will? No, mikan shenitin reshus l'rofei l'rapos. God is telling you, no, it may have been my will, it may or may not have been my will that someone should get injured. It's also my will that you should do whatever you can using the tools of science and nature that I gave you, of skill and human intelligence and wisdom that I gave you, to improve your lot and to improve the lot of other people who are suffering. So that's the reshus shenitin l'rofei l'rapos. Says Rav Waldenberg, that is limited to actual cases of illness, of sickness, of real problems people have, but purely discretionary, elective, cosmetic things, which are not problems in any objective sense, Rav Waldenberg argues, there is no reshus l'rofei l'rapos in such a case, and yesh l'das u'lahamin, a person should know and believe, ki ein tzayar kelokeinu, God is called the great artist, and elsewhere in the Talmud, God is called the great sculptor or artist who makes all human beings, all of creation, the way he wants it. A person should accept that this is God's will. This is how he made people. Each person was made according to God's desire for him. Olav ein lahosif, imenu ein legroa. You shouldn't try to add or subtract to a person. And that is what he says. Therefore, just to change people, to make them look better in our opinion, to be soser gzeres malchus shel olam, to contradict the decree of the king of the world, is improper. He also talks about sakana, that it's an unnecessary assumption of risk. In fact, he says surgery in general carries risk, including certainly elective surgery. The risk is not being assumed for any legitimate reason. So he says that, he actually says in the case of cosmetic surgery, it's often double because there's one surgery to remove some tissue from one part of the body, another surgery to implant it somewhere else. It's like a double surgery, he says, and so on. And therefore, he says, just trust in Hashem and have faith that this is his will and accept it, and that's a proper religious attitude, he says. And then he says, he winds up with some cute little phrasing. He says that anyone who has Yiras Hashem Naga Baliba, any woman who is God-fearing, will not chase such things, such options, like plastic surgery, he says, Nituchim Plastiim, L'Shem Yofi V'Noi Bilvad, Al Pirov, he says, these are, people only care, these are superficial things, he says, that... And he says, and remember what the saying, as the saying goes, he says, Hacheshek ein lo einayim, which in English translates roughly to love is blind. You find the right one, you won't care what you look like. Now, everything he says there, you know, certainly you can find precedents in Judaism for all these values, but everything he says there obviously is debatable and equivocal, and you can make counter-arguments from the Talmud itself. But the Gemara talks about how there were mekel and certain isurim for women to do certain cosmetics, you know, use cosmetics on Tisha B'Av and on other days so that she should find favor in the eyes of her husband. The Torah is very realistic. The Torah might ideally think that all people should, all union should be purely of the soul and that no one should care about anyone he looks like, but the Torah is very realistic. The Torah knows that people are what they are and people want, the heart wants what it wants and so on, and love is blind is nice, but at the end of the day, love sometimes is affected by what the heart sees. The Torah does recognize that looks are important, and many of Rav Waldenberg's arguments are certainly debatable. In terms of his basic position of fatalism, the idea that God made us the way he wanted, and we don't challenge that. So again, that's just, you know, it's not generally the Jewish attitude. He himself admits that when it comes to real healing, so to speak, healing for diseases, that's not the Torah's attitude. We do have reshus to be l'rofei l'rapos. Rav Waldenberg wants to draw the line at cosmetic procedures. But again, we don't generally say it's our job to accept our lot as God made us and move on. We have the right to use, as long as there's no prohibition, we have the right to do whatever we can to improve things. Now again, many of the precedents for this are medical, but in general, throughout Judaism, we have no general doctrine that the world is the way God made it, that we should not attempt to interfere. I gave a talk a little while back on genetic engineering, where this is one of the things that comes up. Some posts can take a kind of fatalistic attitude that God made the world the way he wants it, and we shouldn't interfere. Others push back. No less a figure than the Maral of Prague brings a famous midrash, a famous story from Talmudic times. It says some troublemaker, a Roman, I think, asked one of the rabbis, what's better, God's handiwork or man's? He meant to give him a hard time about bris milah, circumcision. God made you with an arla, who are you to think that you know better? So the rabbi saw where this was going, so he said, man's handiwork is better. So the Roman looked a little puzzled by this, so the rabbi asked him, what's better, he says, what's more attractive? Some wheat, he says, or a cake, or a loaf of fine bread. The bread is better, the cake is better. He said, God gave us the wheat, but he also gave us ingenuity and skill and craft and wisdom and intelligence to do something with the wheat and to improve it and make it into something which is more and more helpful to us, which is more palatable to us, he says. So just because God made somebody a certain way, in no way implies, according to most of the standard doctrines of Judaism, that God insists that we stay like that. God gave us, for reasons best known to him, he made us the way he made us, but that's not meant to be final. We have the right to improve and to do things the way we want. And again, all the poskim who don't make this point to the Tzitz Eliezer kind of tacitly take for granted that this is okay. Again, some of them were talking about deformities, but your Moshe and many others seem to be talking about pretty much the same case, general cosmetic surgery. Moshe also was talking about a nose job, general cosmetic, not Moshe, Rav Libus was, but many of the poskim were talking, seem to be talking about general cosmetic surgery, and almost no one, except Rav Waldenberg, seems to be concerned about this type of submission to the will of God. One authority who explicitly rejects it, or rejects a similar argument, is Rav Vosner, Shevet Alevi. He was asked about, his correspondent had brought up an issue similar to Rav Waldenberg. The issue was, Shekach Nivra, that's how the person was created, V'nikra Shinui V'masya Bereshis. Incidentally, both Rav Waldenberg and Rav Vosner's correspondent talked about the idea that God made you that way, you were created that way. Even they might not apply their din to someone who was injured in an accident or a burn or chas v'shalom or something like that. But even when it's congenital, a person was just born a certain way, Rav Vosner's correspondent also had suggested maybe we should just say kach nivra, that's how God wanted us. He brings the Talmudic expression kishuv. The reason the Torah is opposed to kishuv is because it's machishin pamalya shalmala, because you're trying to use magic to get around the laws of nature, which are God's will. So the Maral says, that's something else. That's when you're actually magically somehow distorting creation, he says. Here you're working within the laws of nature. You're just improving its looks. You're just facilitating it to have a better appearance, he says. Certainly, he says, this is fine. Again, now Rav Vosner was worried about sakana. He was saying if the surgery has some level of sakana, then certainly it's usur. The fact that you want to look better is not a heter to undertake serious risk. But this concern, the concern that you're somehow tampering with the appearance that God gave you, is somehow problematic. Rav Vosner explicitly rejects as being not something Judaism is concerned with. So in general, you know, we do have a prohibition of self-harm. There's a machlokas whether we accept the prohibition against fasting or the prohibition against depriving yourself of wine. In general, people like to write about whether Judaism is in favor of asceticism, against asceticism. We have the Ramban, that Nazirus is good. Other opinions, Nazirus is bad. Tosfos, it's both. But we do accept the prohibition against self-harm, against actual self-injury, like with a knife. Nevertheless, the consensus of pretty much all poskim is that if done for a constructive purpose, such as surgery, and certainly surgery when it's medically not necessary, but even if it's simply for a serious, certainly for a non-frivolous cosmetic reason, it would be okay, perhaps even for a frivolous cosmetic reason. If you happen to think you look better with a body part shaped differently, that might be okay. Many poskim were reluctant to allow cosmetic surgery, but that was mostly for other reasons, reasons that they felt the danger was too high, either the danger of infection or the danger from the surgery itself or the danger from the anesthesia. They went back and forth. Some of them said it is dangerous. Some of them said it's not dangerous. Some of them said it's look at what's regularly done. If it's regularly practiced, it's okay. But Rav Waldenberg uniquely has this, and Rav Ozner's correspondent, I guess, uniquely have this concern that we should simply defer to God's will and accept and just leave ourselves the way God made us. But my sense is that is very much an outlier position. The consensus is that no, that we were put into the world, Avdo L'Shamra, with the tools and the intelligence and wisdom and tools of science and medical skill to change that. And we have the right to alter ourselves insofar as we think it will be an improvement.